Welcome to the Produce Industry Podcast Global Fresh Series, your audio source for international produce markets, trends, market reports, and community discussion. Join us somewhere in the world as we cover all aspects of the international produce and supply chain industry. Ladies and gentlemen, here is your host, Juanita Galio.
Hey, Produce Valentines. Welcome to the international show of the Global Fresh Series. Today is Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2024, and I'm more than happy to spend an hour of my time with all of you Valentines. I am your host, Juanita Galio, coming to you from Long Beach, California. As always, we are excited to have you join us today for another interesting show. But before we get started, a few announcements. On the international front, registration is now open for the upcoming CPMA Convention and Trade Show. The Canadian Produce Marketing Association, April 23rd through the 25th, 2024 in Vancouver, Canada. Head to their website to register. On the home front, mark your calendar for February 29th, Leap Day, at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for the Produce Industry Podcast's upcoming virtual network hour. You won't want to miss this event as we present a special guest, Robert Gunther, founder of Breakthrough 365. A big thank you to our newest sponsor of the Global Fresh Series, proudly Canadian, Peak of the Market, connecting great farmers with caring consumers. Visit their booth 931 at the CPMA Convention and Trade Show to connect with Wayne Dirksen from Hesport Farms. They grow red, yellow, and white potatoes, as well as sweet potatoes. Now today we may not have chocolate or flowers for you, but the next best thing, facts about bees and the collapse of their colonies. This is really important because bees make honey, which can also be related to Valentine's Day, something nice and sweet. Today's guest is Matthias Carpenter, a senior at Harvard University, majoring in the history of science. I became interested in Matthias when I learned that he is doing his thesis on the collapse of bee colonies, also recognized as colony collapse disorder. He will tell us what he has discovered through his research and what factors are attributing to bee colony collapse disorder. I am really pleased to have him join us today. Hey, Matthias, welcome to the Global Fresh Series. You are my first guest of the year. I'm really excited about this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and to kick off the new year too. What a pleasure.
Yeah, and how we met. You never know who you're going to meet when you go to a concert. For the benefit of our audience, we met at the Los Angeles performance of Harvard's World Touring Jazz A Cappella Group. What a talented group of singers, and Matthias was part of the Gin and Tonics. He had to correct me. I thought it was the Gin and Tonics, but it was the Gin and Tonics. I never knew that there could be so much entertainment, which is snapping fingers and boo-bop, da-dop, bop-bop.
No, that's it. Very, very true. I think one of the pleasures of being able to share that kind of music is to just sort of bring the audience into the humor of our singing. And the Dins are a very special group for me, certainly throughout my college experience. And I know that you have listeners from over 90 different countries, and the Dins are going on a world tour this summer, and will probably be performing in 10 to 15 countries. So
wow.
If anyone is interested out there in learning more about where they'll be performing, feel free to check out more. Yeah.
I mean, they were dancing and grooving in the aisle. It was really wonderful. And just by chance, Matthias was sitting next to me and I was introduced to him. And I overheard, what are you doing your thesis on? He replied, bee colonies, where my ears perked up and said, hey, we got to get this guy on the show. Not only can he sing, but he can tell us about bees. So he's a senior at Harvard with a major in the history of science, with most of his academic work focusing on environmental history and climate change. He also has a small orchard as a hobby, growing mostly apples and some pears and peaches, while supporting a beehive in partnership with local beekeepers. I will pass it on to Matthias to fill in his background and how he came to study this unique science, which I wish I would have realized that there was a major like that when I went to college.
for
let's
sure.
Hear about it.
Yeah, thank you, Juanita. So I think it might be helpful to contextualize my major, which, as Juanita said, is the history of science. It's a fairly niche department. I think most students, when they come to Harvard, have never heard of it. I certainly wasn't familiar with it. And I realized as I started studying both sort of botany, like plant sciences, as well as the humanities, I wanted something that would combine both of those disciplines. And so I sort of happened upon the History of Science department. And just for to sort of fill people in on what that means, it's a department that examines the traditionally structured sciences like chemistry, physics, biology, and also the social sciences. So take economics, political science, and the like, and you sort of explore the history of knowledge and knowledge production across all of those fields, and the role that science plays in shaping our history, including how it relates to politics, economics, religion, government, society, more broadly. And so, for example, a topic that would fit into the history of science would be, I wrote a paper last year on how agricultural pesticides were sort of co-opted and further developed by the military to synthesize Agent Orange, which was a broadleaf chemical defoliant that was used extensively in offensive campaigns military by the U.S. military.
Right? Yeah,
in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And so the history of science really allows us to put a critical lens on the sciences, which often we see as a discipline of absolute truth. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I am someone who wants to trust the science and believe the science and all of that. But I think when you're able to dive deeper into how science has shaped a lot of our lives and sort of the world that we live in today, that's where the department comes in. And that's where the work is really important.
And so did you lean towards this thesis with bees and the collapse of the colonies due to your interest in you started off with, you said, a backyard hobby, growing apples, pears, and peaches?
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. So I think ever since I was little, I've always had an interest in gardening, being outside, planting carrots and radishes. Those were always my favorite because they would pop up before any other plant. And I think gardening really tests your patience when it comes to and then fast forward to the spring of 2020. I was a freshman in college, and we had just been sent home after COVID had broken out in the U.S. And I think COVID, in addition to sort of the toll that it placed on people's lives, it also forced a lot of us, by being stuck at home, to rediscover our backyards and our neighborhoods, and familiarize ourselves more with our surroundings. And so I, like many Americans, and I'm not sure if this trend sort of stretched into other countries, got really into bread baking.
And that was another one thing during the pandemic, was everyone got into baking bread.
Yeah, right. So I had my own sourdough starter, and as someone who loves science and cooking, I was especially interested in sort of the chemistry of sourdough and all of that.
This works, yeah.
Right. But to bring the gardening element back in, I live in northeastern Massachusetts, greater Boston area, a part of the country that is pretty built up and industrialized. However, I was really keen on understanding the entire process of baking bread, going backwards, not to the starter, not to the flour, but to the crop itself, to thinking about how you can actually grow grasses and then mill them into flour. So what started as a pandemic passion project turned into a somewhat failed experiment to grow wheat in my backyard in suburban Massachusetts. I can't say that venture was really prepared me to become an industrial farmer, but it did make me think a lot about how our agriculture system works. And it got me into exploring on the web, just how we grow things. And I think as someone who comes from an urban area, I don't often think about how that sort of stuff works.
How it gets to it. Yeah. Now, before this, had you ever had any other exposure to agriculture, like any other growers? I mean, Massachusetts is big for cranberries. Anything
right.
with this?
Yeah, cranberries, apples, blueberries. I think beyond going into orchards in the summer and fall to pick fruit, my exposure to agriculture was pretty limited. But as I kept reading about industrial farming, I sort of saw this trend in how everything has become mechanized. So whether that's furrowing a field, sowing seeds, harvesting, packaging, distribution, like all of that has become increasingly technologically complex. I mean, tractors, for example, now.
Yep.
Yeah, I know. It's really incredible. Like, tractors are more computer than they are vehicle now. Mm-hmm. That just fascinated me. And as I started digging deeper into this topic, I learned that there was a critical component of agriculture that didn't really fit that mold. And there's one element that can't be mechanized, and that's pollination. And the vast majority of crops are not self-pollinating, so they require something to deposit pollen onto their flowers so that they can produce fruit. I'll concede here that there are some companies that are trying to mechanically pollinate crops like almonds. I know there's an Israeli startup that's trying to do that. But I think by and large, as a scalable solution, we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. And so pollination for the majority of cases is carried out by bees in agricultural settings. And, there's so many different animals that pollinate, bats, lemurs, birds, and then bugs like bees. But there's one species that's really better than all of them for a broad spectrum of applications. And that's the European honeybee, or Apis mellifera. And so I kept digging into this topic. And eventually when my junior spring rolled around and I signed up to write a thesis, because I wanted to challenge myself to work on a longer term research project, bees came to mind as something that was really worth exploring. Yeah. And as something that definitely is unexplored in a lot of ways when thinking about agricultural history. And it sort of breaks the mold of this increasingly mechanized process. And so that's where I arrived. And as with any research project, one of the first goals is trying to narrow the scope of your topic.
I think this is great leading up into our break now. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to hear what happened with the thesis, what some of your findings are, and what you're going to do with this. So this is a perfect time to take a quick break and hear from our fabulous sponsors and those relationships in the produce and supply chain industry. We'll be right back.
Are you ready to elevate your produce aisle and captivate customers with fresh, high-quality vegetables? Look no further than Peak of the Market, where we connect great farmers with caring consumers. Visit booth 931 at the CPMA Convention and Trade Show to connect with our passionate staff and growers to discover how we're working to fill half of every plate across North America. Learn how our core value of being rooted in growers drives every decision we make. From seed to plate, Peak unites the entire supply chain with a full service team handling everything from sales to logistics, packing, and distribution. We've got your veggie needs covered. Don't miss out. Visit Peak of the Market at booth 931 from April 23rd to April 25th at the CPMA Convention and Trade Show in Vancouver, Canada.
Welcome back to the Global Fresh Series. If you are just joining us, welcome, and a big thank you to all of our sponsors. Let's return to our interesting discussion with Matthias Carpenter and his study and thesis on the collapse of bee colonies. Matthias, back to you.
Thanks very much. So I think where we left off, I had just arrived at the topic of honeybees, which is really broad. The European honeybee is definitely, yeah.
How did you narrow this down? And also, are there certain bees that are disappearing versus other bees that might be not so affected by some of these environmental factors?
Yeah, definitely. I think what's important to delineate between is the beekeeping or the side of beekeeping and sort of bees as a population of insects that is specifically hold on, can I try that again? Do you mind just asking your question again?
I don't know a lot about bees other than they sting you and that they do pollinate. They are valuable. I mean, need them for everything, for life, literally. They pollinate everything that we eat. So I'd like to know a little bit more about, are there different varieties of bees, kind of like crops, and are some more susceptible to the environmental versus others that might be a little hardier?
Yeah, that's a great question. To begin, all bees at the end of the day are still insects. So they have their own biological limitations and susceptibilities to certain pressures, whether those are environmental or biological. And so I think for as much of the history of agriculture would show about bees and sort of their role in pollinating crops, there's a limit on the sort of environment that they can be raised and cultivated in before they sort of are susceptible to these pressures. So specifically with colony collapse disorder, which I think is important to contextualize here, in the early 2000s, beekeepers started noticing that their colonies after the winter season were dying off in larger numbers than they usually expected. I think on average, it's not a surprise, and it's sort of part of the process for 10% of a hive to die off in the winter. But in the springtime, in around 2006, 2007, beekeepers started noticing that 75% or more of their hives were dying. And this was happening across the country, and no one really understood why. So
happening in other parts of the world outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, it definitely was. The focus of most of my research has been in the United States, so I can't speak too much to the impact of honeybee health and hive productivity abroad. But it certainly was trending across the world. Especially in beekeeping is essential to agriculture. In California, where 80% of the world's almonds are grown, you've got millions, I think it's 1.6 million acres of land is used for almond orchards. And the only way to pollinate all of those trees presently at scale is to use beehives. And so every year, thousands and thousands of beehives are trucked across the state from anywhere in the country where beekeepers are sort of where they've based their operations.
I also read that they were airshipping them in from New Zealand.
Are they really?
Yeah, I read that not too long ago. Might have been one of the trade publications. I'll have to look for that. That's what piqued my interest as well. I mean, and they were coming here on vacation. They were coming here to pollinate the crops.
Yeah. Yeah, bees are, if bees are anything, they're hard workers, for sure. And with almonds and this sort of this form of beekeeping, which is called migratory beekeeping, as the name would explain, you are migrating bee colonies across the country so that they can pollinate in specific farmlands for wherever those crops are grown. So fast forward 2006, colony collapse disorder becomes a notable phenomenon. And the USDA takes interest in this. they draft an action plan, put together a committee with regulators and scientists to try and understand what the causes are of colony collapse disorder. What's causing all of these bees to die? And it was immensely concerning to every single stakeholder in the agriculture industry, because bees contribute more than $12 billion annually directly to agricultural output and crop yields. Mm-hmm. And so naturally, without them, you don't have any of the operators in agriculture with jobs, whether those are agrochemical mm-hmm. companies, growers, farmers, distributors, anyone who's manufacturing agricultural equipment. So they're vitally important. And in this report, the USDA concluded that there were a number of leading causes, one being the varroa mite, which is a parasitic mite that was first discovered in North Carolina in the 80s. And it debilitates bees, prevents them from flying, shortens their lives, and it spreads most rapidly in dense apiaries. And often these are the types of apiaries that are trucking their beehives to farmland. Mm-hmm. So the varroa mite was one cause. Another was poor nutrition. Just think about if you've got a hive of bees that are in 1,000 acres of almond orchard, there's really only one crop that they're pollinating. There's one flower that they're getting nectar from. And bees, again, to go back to my earlier point, are insects. So if you are giving an insect that has evolved to consume a varied diet of sugars, and they happen to only be getting nutrients from one plant, that's going to impede their ability to grow properly and function. And so that was certainly putting stress on these mm-hmm. hives. And then some other causes, just to sort of go through them a little more efficiently, were migratory stress. Just think about, like, if you're always on the move, a nomadic lifestyle is not something that the bee conforms to very well. And it leads to increased disease susceptibility if you're constantly trucking them around and they have to adapt to their surroundings.
Are they doing much more migration because of different crops further out, or how is that?
Bees are, they're sometimes limited in how far they can fly, but certainly if there's a lot of competition within a nearby area to pollinate, like if a beekeeper has decided, well, we can more efficiently pollinate all of these flowers in this orchard by placing all of these beehives here, you might also at the same time be limiting the amount of nutrients that is received by each bee. Okay. And so that can lead to instances where the bees have to begin foraging further mm-hmm. out. And this is also a huge problem for the non-agricultural, non-sort of utilitarian side mm-hmm. of bees, where you have other pollinators that are native to those areas that have been converted into farmland mm-hmm. that now are facing competition with the bees that have been brought there to pollinate the flowers that are available. And then to bring climate change into this, you also have a drought, which certainly in California has been a perennial issue, as well as across so many other parts of the
country. Right, so they have all these things going against them.
Right.
Just different environmental things that just don't it's not in their favor.
Right, right. And then I'd be remiss if I didn't bring in pesticides, which have been a huge part of this story. And this includes chemicals like neonicotinoids, which are used on...
They're highly toxic to the bees then.
Right. Those chlorpyrifos, sulfoxaflor, these are pesticides that are used across a broad spectrum of flowering plants. And a lot of research has come out in recent years showing a direct link between these chemicals and the decline in bee health. But I think sort of the ultimate realization through writing this, through researching all these different elements that shaped and caused colony collapse disorder, is that part of the problem with that bees face, especially honeybees, which are not native to North America, is that farmers and people in the agriculture industry have tried to integrate an insect into a mechanized industry at scale, and the same limitations that that any biological creature faces when you're trying to conform it to a system that doesn't necessarily allow for that, is that you end up putting pressure on that population and sort of disabling it from flourishing as well as it could be. So the conclusion that I've drawn here is that if we really want to address the pollination crisis and colony mm-hmm. collapse disorder, the causes that the USDA identified are certainly important and help us understand some of the problem, but they don't really pick at the underlying issue, which is that we have to rethink how we beekeep, both in the US and abroad, if we want to ensure the long-term health of all pollinators. And so that would include being more conscious about
the environment
and monoculture, monocrop farming practices, about pesticide usage, about keeping one species of bee as opposed to a diverse array of pollinators. And there are plenty of pollinators out there that are more efficient and effective at pollinating particular crops. So that, to summarize, is what my thesis is about, exploring colony collapse disorder, the plight of the honeybees and native pollinators. It's certainly something that is really important
it's very relevant. Yeah, it's a topic that's right there front and center, and it's growing even more because, as you said, you need those bees to pollinate. And when you have that much acreage with almonds or berries or any crop, they need the bees there.
I
love this discussion, and I wish we could talk. We could talk for quite some time, even further.
Me too.
We'll have to reschedule another interview once you really, wrap up your thesis. And
of course, yeah.
I know that you have some interest in getting into the field, certain growers, maybe some almond growers, lettuce growers. So, if you want to share your contact details, where people can reach you for more questions on this interesting subject, what you're doing your thesis on, or if you wanted to try to meet some of the growers here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as with any research process, there's always more that can be done, and something I haven't been able to integrate into my research so far has been interviews with farmers, with beekeepers. So if anyone out there is involved in the almond industry, works closely with apiarists and migratory beekeepers, more specifically, I would love to talk with you about what that relationship is like, how it's changed over the past few years and decades. So you can email me at mcarpenter@college.harvard.edu. I would love
LinkedIn.
To get in touch.
Yeah,
oh, LinkedIn. And LinkedIn, of course. Yeah, yeah, Mateus Carpenter on LinkedIn. Look me up.
MATTHEUS.
Exactly.
Carpenter, CARPENTER. So, yeah, you've got a great LinkedIn profile. Talking about.
Oh, thank you.
No, I've loved it. This has been a different type of interview, but one that is so relevant globally. It's affecting everyone, and I hope to have you back maybe once you get the thesis completed and find out what some of the findings are, more of the findings. So
I would love to, and thank you so much for bringing me on the show to share more about this topic.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It has been a pleasure to have you join us today, and as we say here at the Produce Industry Podcast, we will see you in the fields and on the horizon.
You've been listening to the Produce Industry Podcast Global Fresh Series with Juanita Galio. Be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon to get new fresh episodes. For more, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Produce Industry Podcast. Until next time, see you in the fields or on the horizon.